Today we celebrate one of the great fixed feasts in the year, the Feast of Peter and Paul. It is a joyful day for the church because today we celebrate these princes of the apostles and we also conclude the Apostles' Fast. We will, after the Divine Liturgy, celebrate, of course, with some meat and nice sandwiches. The Feast of Peter and Paul and the fast originally are not connected as far as we can tell historically. Historically, what is called the Apostles' Fast, as it is called today because of the feast, developed very early in the church, possibly one of the earliest, if not the earliest, fast of all. It was originally, as far as we can discern by looking at the references in the patristic tradition, a 1 week fast that followed immediately after the octave of Pentecost. Remember, we had the Feast of Pentecost, and that octave concluded with the Sunday of All Saints, the fruit of Pentecost. And then the church would enter into a 1 week fast, preparing everyone in the church for what they now had to go out and do as all saints go out and sanctify the world, go out and preach the gospel, a new Pentecost celebrated every year. And so the church would do this to begin its mission, to prepare itself for its mission each year. It would begin with this fast. The other fast, as you know, we talked about these before, were actually for the catechumens. But this was a fast for all of the faithful. Eventually, with the memory of Saints Peter and Paul, and the fixing of the date of that memory, the feast, or this fast, eventually stretches its way out to meet the fixed feast, and it becomes then a variable length fast, depending on when Pascha occurred that year, and then when we will arrive at the Feast of Peter and Paul. The Feast of Peter and Paul. We remember Peter and Paul, princes of the apostles. In the icon, you will usually see them holding up a little model church in their hands. Or in this icon here, you can see the church between the two of them set on the in the background. This is because they are pillars of the church. All of the apostles, of course, were pillars of the church. But these two, as we know as we read the early church story in Acts of the Apostles, if we look at the content of the New Testament, we find that these two individuals were giants among the apostles. Giants among the apostles. You heard in the reading about St. Paul. We heard from 2 Corinthians because 2 Corinthians is the epistle of Paul where his apostleship is being challenged. And it's in 2 Corinthians that we have the most detailed apostolic witness to the role of the apostle as understood in the early church. Because the Corinthian church, being infested with heretics, false apostles who were causing the Corinthian church to question Paul's authority, Paul now had to write his second epistle to them, letting them know that he is going to arrive shortly. He probably wrote this from Philippi, somewhere up in Macedonia, we know for sure. And he's about to arrive within a few days in Corinth. But before he arrives, he sends them this second epistle to prepare them for his imminent arrival, to make sure these false apostles either get out of town or clean the situation up. Because when Paul arrives, he says, we will not be having a contest of talk, of rhetoric, but rather a contest of the power of God. So, Paul eventually arrives in Corinth and cleans things up, as far as we can discern, at least for a while. The Corinthian church, as you read from Clement, one of the apostolic writings, seems to have fallen into trouble again. So, we hear from Paul's long curriculum vitae, as he gives it in 2 Corinthians, showing his authority, his background, his life of suffering, which for Paul, the life of suffering was the testament that he was a true apostle. And so you heard of these details. St. Paul, 3 journeys before his imprisonment, a 4th journey after that into Macedonia, in which he wrote the pastoral epistles. And during those other journeys, of course, you know of his other epistles he wrote, and all of the places he traveled, all of the churches he founded, a giant among the apostles. St. Peter, you know of him among the 12, the original 12 that Jesus chose. And from the early stages, we see Jesus setting Peter apart, giving him a special role. We see this from the very first moment they encounter each other in John's Gospel, when Andrew brings Simon, his brother, to Jesus. This is on that first initial visit when they see each other. Jesus says in chapter 1, verse 42 of that Gospel, he says, "Ah, so you are Simon. You shall be called Kephas." That's the Aramaic word for rock. And then John translates into Greek there for us, which means Petros, which means Peter. Assuming his audience there in the 90s don't know all the Aramaic they might need to know. And then throughout the rest of the story of Jesus' ministry, we see Jesus setting Simon apart. He sets apart not only from the 70 disciples, his 12 that he sends out. They're called apostles. We hear about this in Matthew chapter 10, where he sets apart from these crowds of followers, these crowds of disciples, 12, whom he sends out. Apostolos in Greek, one who is sent, he who is sent. And so he sends them out in Matthew chapter 10 in that kind of trial run before Jesus' passion. He sends them out midway through his ministry. They've heard enough. They've seen enough. They go out there and preach the gospel. And then come back and tell me what happens. Apostles. Among those 12, Jesus sets aside 3 great men: Peter, James, and John. Probably intended in Matthew's Gospel to remind us of how David in the Old Testament, though he had the army of Israel, right, the disciples of Jesus, though he had his special guard, that would be the 12 apostles for Jesus, David had 3 great men who never left his side. And whatever he told them to do, they would do. These were called the mighty men of David. There's a whole chapter about them in the book of 2 Chronicles, or 1 Chronicles. But among those 3, Peter, James, and John, whom he brings up into the upper room, he brings further into the garden, he takes up onto the top of the Mount of Transfiguration, these 3 he keeps setting aside, these great pillars in the early church, Peter, James, and John. Among those 3, Peter is set apart a few times. You can think to when Jesus gives the parable in Luke's Gospel about the master who goes away and he leaves the house in charge of his servants, and there's one servant who is in charge of the household. He has set him in charge of the household, it says. And when he comes back, if that servant has been drunk and beating the other servants and not doing his job, then woe to that servant, he says. But if he's done a good job, then he'll be rewarded. Peter says in Luke's Gospel, "Lord, are you saying this for all of them, the crowd? Or is this just for us, you know, the 12?" He says, "Peter, Simon, who then is the servant whom the Lord shall set over his house?" So, Simon, I hope you're paying attention. Because, yes, it's for everybody listening. And yes, it's for the 12. And yes, it's for the 3. But, Simon, you better be listening, because this is especially for you. The servant whom he has set over the house. Over the house. We'll come back to that in a second. We find later on in the Gospel a few other places where Simon is set aside. Simon has great courage. As you know, in individuals who have great courage, sometimes they get themselves into trouble with that courage. Right? Remember when they're in the boat in Matthew's Gospel and they're crossing the sea and there's a storm and Jesus isn't with them and Jesus comes walking on the water. Matthew tells us that when they're all scared, Simon says, "If it's really you, Lord, then call to me, I'll come out to you on the water." And he begins to walk out there on the water. Amazing faith of this man. Incredible courage. They all think he's a ghost. Simon has enough courage to speak to this individual who may be a ghost, maybe the Lord, let's check it out. Right? And then he has the courage to get on the water and walk. Now, is he perfect? No. He begins to sink. Right? And Jesus says, Simon, says, "Oh, man of little faith, why did you doubt? You were doing so well." And, you know, we might look at Simon and say, "Oh, he really seems to have messed up there. You know, he could have..." What about the other apostles, right? The other apostles are cowering in the back of the boat. Right? Cowering in the back of the boat. So, at the end of the Gospels, at the end of Luke's Gospel, Jesus says to Simon, "Simon, Simon, Satan has desired to sift you all." In the Greek, plural. All of you, my 12. This was at the Last Supper. "But I have prayed for you," it's in the singular there in the Greek, "that when you have returned," when you have repented, all right, we know what Simon's going to do. "When you have repented, you shall strengthen your brethren." Strengthen your brethren. We can see that in Acts of the Apostles, that model of Peter from Luke's Gospel. Remember, Luke writes Acts. You can see that same image there. Peter strengthening, being this hub of the wheel that kind of holds things together for the apostles, especially in those first few chapters. You know, of course, at the end of John's Gospel, where Jesus sets Simon apart and says, "Feed my sheep and my lambs." But the reading we heard today is the passage that is usually seen as showing, most importantly, Simon's very special role among the 12. In Matthew chapter 16, verse 13 and following, we heard about Simon when all the others are guessing that, well, Jesus could maybe be maybe John the Baptist. You kind of look like him, right? They were genetically related. You look like him. Doing the same thing, the water, the baptism down by the Jordan, your disciples, some of the same disciples. Maybe Jeremiah. In second, the Protestants are often confused about why they say Jeremiah here. It's because in 2 Maccabees, missing from a Protestant Bible, Jeremiah appears as the prophet who hands Judas Maccabeus the sword to destroy the Gentiles, which is what they were waiting for the Messiah to do at this point. And so then, he says, "Yeah, but what do you guys say? My 12 who have been with me for 3 years. Time for the final exam." And Simon says, again, remember that great courage. He'll speak up. Whatever's on his mind, he's just going to say. Whether it's right or wrong. Sometimes, as you know, the next episode with him telling him not to go to Jerusalem, he gets it wrong. But Simon says, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God, the Son of God. Messiah. You are the one we've been waiting for." This is a framing device. This is the bookend to the baptism. In the baptism, the Spirit descended and appeared, and the people saw and realized when they heard the voice, "This is my Son, the Son of God." They realized, those who were standing there at the Jordan that day, realized that God had revealed that this man was the Messiah, the anointed one, the one indwelt by the Spirit of God, the Christ. After 3 years, which is complete in the Bible, Jesus then asks his disciples, "What do you say?" And they say what God said. "You are the Christ, the Son of God." Good. Now let's go to Jerusalem. Right? The rest of the episode then is taken up with the second part of the Gospel, which begins with the Transfiguration, revealing that Jesus is not just the Messiah, but he's the divine King from all eternity, which will conclude and climax with the resurrection story, that in another homily. But Jesus says to Simon now, "Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Yonah, son of John, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you." You didn't figure this out through logic. "But my Father in heaven has revealed this to you. And so I call you rock, and upon this rock I will build my church. This text appears only in Matthew's gospel for a very Jewish audience. The other gospel authors don't anticipate this kind of knowledge of the Old Testament of their audiences, so they don't give you this information. But Matthew knows in this early Christian Jewish context, they'll grasp what he's saying. So he tells you what Jesus said. You are rock, and upon this rock I will build my church. This is a memory back to Solomon, the son of David, who built the temple, the house of God, on the rock of Moriah. That rock is still there today, covered with that Muslim shrine, the Dome of the Rock. God willing, someday we'll turn that back into a church. The statement, you are the rock, and upon whom I will build my church, is an identity of Jesus. Often today, in a post-Reformation Western society, this passage is used to whack your Baptist friend over the head with, right? But think back to before the Baptists were around, before Luther was around, before there was a Reformation, before there was a debate about the role of Peter. Then you think, what did the passage mean? Ah, it's Christocentric. It focuses on Christ. If Jesus is the Christ, then what is he supposed to be doing? He is the Christ, the Son of David. You remember in 2 Samuel chapter 7, God had given a very special promise through Nathan the prophet to David that only his line would remain on the throne. And it would be the Son of David who would build the house for the Lord. And so now Jesus appears as that Christ, Son of David. And they realize who he is. The Davidic line will now continue. And so now it is time to begin to rebuild the house. Right? The house for the Lord. And that is the church. The other words we hear Jesus say to him about the keys is again a reference to another Davidic image. The king in the Old Testament had a prime minister. Among his ministers, his servants in the palace, one of them had a special role. He was kind of like a manager. He was one of the servants. He wasn't the king, but he had a managerial role. And that role was called the Al-Habayith, the over the house. The over the house. Remember back to Luke's gospel? What servant has been put over the house? In Isaiah chapter 22, we hear about the removal of one of these Al-Habayiths, one of these over-the-house ministers. Shebna was not doing his job. The Assyrian army was coming to Jerusalem. Hezekiah is running around, digging his tunnels and making sure everything's okay and ready for when the Assyrians attack. And Shebna, his right-hand man, his Al-Habayith, is building a nice monument tomb for himself so that everyone will remember how great he was. So God sends Isaiah to Shebna. He says, go to Shebna, the Al-Habayith, the over the house, and tell him, you will be cast down from your throne. Your robe will be removed, right? Your belt, your authority. And I will give it to Eliakim. And Eliakim will do what you were supposed to be doing. Be a father to the inhabitants of the people. The inhabitants of Jerusalem. And so this is what he was supposed to do. And of course, he says, I will give to you, he says to Eliakim, the key of the house of David. What you shut, no one will open. What you open, no one will shut. This is the ancient world, remember, when you didn't have thumb turns on the locks. The key opened and closed the door, and that was it. And so the image here is an image of authority. That installation of an Al-Habayith in Isaiah 22, then, we find that same basic language in Matthew 16, though it's translated from Aramaic into Greek and then into English, and so you miss some of it. But this is the image. Simon's being given this special role as the Al-Habayith. He's one of the ministers, one of the servants of the kingdom, like the other apostles are. But among the servants, if Jesus is the Christ, the Davidic king, then he's going to have a Davidic empire. A Davidic kingdom. And we find reflections of that in the early church of this Old Testament image, the types and the antitypes. The mother of the king, the queen mother, we find in the Virgin Mary. More on that in another homily. The Al-Habayith of the king in the Old Testament, we find in the role of Simon. And so today we glorify Peter and Paul, princes of the apostles, leaders, the strength, the pillar of the early church. And with them, Jesus Christ is glorified with His eternal Father and His all-holy and life-giving Spirit, both now and ever, unto ages of ages. Amen.